This is Surviving the Music Industry.
That sounds sick.
I didn't think about how that sounded.
Oh my gosh, we listened to this again? Yes. I don't know, you clicked it. You decided to listen to it. I didn't make you do anything. If you're a repeat offender, thanks for stopping in. If you're brand new to this thing, you're listening to Surviving the Music Industry with Brandon Harrington. That is I. And you're walking into a usual situation, I promise you. Nothing is out of the ordinary. You're fitting right in, I promise. Welcome, pull up a seat, pull up a chair, or you can work out. You can do whatever you want. You can be listening to the conversation. You just can't take part in the conversation. Why? Because we recorded this already. That's the big thing. But you can always get in touch with us at SMI Podcast on Facebook, Twits, at Unofficial Brandon on the Grams and the Talks. And then you can take part of the conversation there way after it's been done. I tried doing the, hey, you guys got questions? Seemed like nobody really cared, so I just stopped doing it. But that's the way that it rolls. So I'm surviving the music industry, and I get to have conversations with people. And it's usually people, I'm kind of downplaying it. It's always people like within music, because that's what it is, surviving the music industry. I'm not doing very well. I don't do well. And that's maybe a self-fulfilling prophecy. But, yeah, I've always struggled. And I think everybody struggles. And it seems like when I do talk to people that aren't surviving the music industry, at least, but they always feel like they are. So it's always an interesting conversation starter. But today's show is John Randall. Super stoked. It's a long episode. We should get into it. But you know we're not. We're not. So pull up a chair. Go start running. Go to sleep. Wake up. I don't know. Whatever you do with podcasts, this is it. I just had an air conditioning guy come take a look at my AC unit. The actual, like, thing outside, not the unit, thermostat on the inside. And it's just, like, service stuff. And, you know, I always get cautious about the whole thing of, you know, I pay for this monthly premium to be backed up in case something just doesn't work. You know, it breaks down. So every 6 months, they come out and service the thing. Well, it's about time for that service deal. So he does the thing, and he's just like, sir, I got this. It's kind of, it's degrading. Probably a good time to change it. Well, should I really change it? I mean, I don't ever look at that thing in the back, so I probably know more about it than you do. I just kind of felt like that. He was thinking that in his eyes. But I tried to make it sound like, you know, do I really need it, you know, or is it one of those things of like, well, once it's broken, we can fix it, you know, is it really a big deal? So from the last report, even to now, long story short, I ended up buying it. I ended up doing the thing. It made sense in my head. Well, as he's changing it, I'm a little nerdy. I kind of want to know, you know, the insides and what's going on. He's like, so what do you do? Well, I'm a podcaster, and, you know, I talk to people. He's like, well, don't be too excited about it. Well, here's the problem. If I really acted too excited about it, I feel like I would just be rubbing it in your face. Maybe you hate your job. Maybe you love your job. I don't know. We didn't get into that conversation. You're just here to service my AC unit. So I didn't feel like, you know, jumping for joy to let you know that I get to kind of work from home most of the time and have conversations with people that don't get to have these conversations at all. And so it's truly a blessing. Like, and he didn't make me feel bad, but it made me realize, like, do I really just come off like I don't care? Or like I degrade myself so much that when I'm truly excited about something, I just like bring myself down to begin with? I don't know. I guess I'm asking for a friend. I call it my Irish upbringing, that there's just some self-loathing. But I'm ecstatic. I'm happy for this long journey of SMI, of the actual show, because there's people like, there's no way I would have met, even if I was touring and doing the thing. I mean, John Randall, for example, he's not on the road. Why would I ever meet John Randall on the road? For all you people, thanks for listening. Continue to listen. At SMI Podcast, Facebook, Twitter, at Unofficial Brandon, Instagram, and the Talks. Continue the conversations. And the thunder rolls. I really got to get this done before it knocks out everything, which is a possibility. Back to John Randall. We ended up talking over the interwebs for close to 3 hours of just purely shooting the shit. So what you guys are actually going to listen to is about the first hour, 15 minutes. The rest of the conversation, that's for me. And that was for him. It was a lot of fun to get to know him on this level. I had no idea. I've always been a little bit too scared, embarrassed to introduce myself when we like run across one another. But now we really had a chance to do it. So I got to know him on a very, very, very deep level. All right, so what can I tell you about John Randall? John Randall is purely a badass in every sense of the word, of musicianship, songwritership, musicality, producership. I mean, you name it, he's kind of got it, and he's done it. So he was a Nash Rambler, Emmylou Harris's band. She's got a Grammy, Live at the Ryman. He was in that band at that time, for you folks that know that record. I mean, like, he was holding chops up against Jerry Rice. Like, he was playing those parts and playing them just as good, if not better, which is crazy to think. Okay? So fast forward just a little bit, he gets signed to a record deal. He starts doing the artist thing. Well, just like most of my friends, most of the people that are purely badasses, they have records that they do release. Maybe they don't do very well because something else is happening. So the universe is saying, nah, 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 no, 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 this is not for you. But something else will be greater down the road. But he didn't know that at the time. So we talk about a little bit of his artist career. So he did the artist thing and kind of landed and found himself as a songwriter. I mean, should we just... I hate to like deduce one man's career down to one song, but it's insane not to mention it. Whiskey Lullaby, Brad Paisley, Alison Krauss. He is one half of the people that wrote this song. And it's regarded, and maybe I'm putting on it too, it's one of the best country music songs ever written, ever recorded. Whiskey Lullaby. So we talk about that. And the passage of that song and how it got to be the thing. And so numerous awards, IBMA, some BMI stuff, Billboard chart awards. I mean, he's been on the top of his game for, I don't know, I would say 20 years as a songwriter. That makes sense. I mean, so cuts that include Reba McEntire, Emmylou, Mira Morris, Dierks Bentley. He produces some Dierks records. And Kenny Chesney, Kip Moore, Brad Paisley, Scotty McCreery, Guy Clark. Of course, we talk about Guy Clark. That's amazing. You can check out all his playlists from Apple Music, Spotify, because he's got a songbook. He's got a thing, because he does the thing. That Up on the Ridge record, is so good. He produced that, by the way. I mean, such a student of Texas music. And bluegrass, you'll hear that in conversation. I mean, we just go to town. We have a good time. I mean, he's done the thing, and he's been across the board doing the thing for the past 4 decades. It's insane. And so it was a great conversation. I guess why was he here? This is why, you know, he was here, because he's coming to do the thing, Neon Texas, his latest EP. It's been the newest thing from him personally, like in the past 15 years. Why do you want to do this to yourself, John Randall? 15 years not doing the artist thing. You got something itching and burning. He wanted to put it out. So we do talk about it, why he wanted to put it out. But the biggest, latest release, probably mostly everybody has probably heard it this time. He was on Jimmy Fallon not that long ago. I watched it because it was fun. It was fun to see him up there. It was the Marfa Tapes, Miranda Lambert and Jack Ingram. He's the third. He's the third of the Caballeros. I really don't know what that means. I just know it's the birds on Disney. But anyway, he's doing the artist thing. He makes a joke. He cuts jokes about it. Great, amazing projects. Nothing but success for one of the best musicians, songwriters out of Nashville that will go down in history as one of the best. And it's a great conversation. So glad I get to share that with all you people. So I think without further ado, be sure to go check out Neon Texas. Amazing songs. Solely written by the guy himself. If you're a student of songwriting, just even good songs. Neon Texas. And of course, the Marfa Tapes are out. But without further ado, here we go. Here's my conversation with B. John Randall. Where are you at right now?
I'm in Franklin.
Oh, okay.
In my little workspace here.
I gotta admit, it looks like that B room in Southern Ground.
Oh yeah, I wish it was. I'm trying to block you from that light because it's kind of bright. But without it, I don't know if you can see me. Let me turn it off and see. You can see me without that behind my head. Is it too dark or is it okay?
No, that works. That's actually a lot better.
And then you can see my bullhorns in the back. So.
I know, man. Dude, that's Texas.
Sometimes 100%. I'll sit just right. I can put them like right there. try to do that.
I love that. That's good, Ben. All right, so I don't know if you know this, but we've met just in passing. And nothing like fancy or anything.
Yeah.
But over at Southern Ground, I would see you kind of come in and out.
Yeah. Yeah. You've been around town a bit too, man. I mean,
you've
ran the circuit noodling up and down the neck too.
You know, that's what it feels like. It just kind of feels like you're noodling. Like,
yeah. Noodle until you find it.
Right. That's what my life feels like. It's just a big giant noodle.
Yeah. That was like an old Jethro, Homer and Jethro joke was, you know, Jethro Burns was this fantastic jazz mandolin player, you know, and he was always noodling, and the other guy was always playing, Homer was always playing just bar chords, you know, just like chunk chords. They had this skit where he said, why is it that I'm just working all up and down this neck and you're just standing there holding one note? He said, well, because I finally found it. You're still looking for it. And it goes back to that Chet Atkins line about there's no money past the third fret, you know?
Right. Yeah.
Those guys said that. It's like, there's no money past the third fret. Just remember that.
Bro, like whoever set that up was genius because I went to school for classical guitar. I could do some sweet picks.
Yeah.
Did none of that shit. None of it.
Yeah. No. When I used to play with Sam Bush, you know, I worked really hard in that band to try to keep up with the, you know, the all that new grass and Tony Ross kind of stuff. I got to a point where I'd worked really hard on it and kind of had worked it out. And, you know, I'd play these real intricate, crazy jam solos and I'd get a little bit of an applause, you know. And then one time I forgot to bring my electric guitar for a gig. So I plugged my D28 into a rat pedal.
Yeah.
And I hit that rat pedal and I played the most obnoxious, like busy Billy Gibbons solo. And the crowd went crazy. And I went, well, there you go. I did all that work only to find out that my big applause is a bar trick with a rat pedal, you know?
isn't that the perfect picture of just what works? You work and you strive so hard for something so perfect, but then it just becomes a shit show and that's what everybody wants.
That's what they want, man. That's what they want.
You got to give the people what they want at that point.
You do, man. Sometimes you got to put the clown suit on and just...
Oh, yeah. I got to ask this. Is everybody okay? Like, I mean, we're coming over the hump, over crazy year, family, everybody doing good?
Yeah, everybody's good, man. We're kind of, you know, we're back at it. I mean, and as you know, I mean, you know, I feel really bad for a lot of my buddies that were touring guys, you know, that were out on the road. You know, it's been a really tough run for them. As far as... you know, writing, like Jesse, you know, she's writing every day, or other, you know, even when it was just Zoom before you could get in the room. I've just been really busy, really blessed, busy, but super busy. And I finally, it dawned on me that the deal is that, you know, nobody knew if touring was going to come back. You know, they're talking about 2022, you know, and so everybody's been in a holding pattern. And then a couple of months ago when they were like, oh yeah, we're going to start booking some dates in July and into the, you know, late summer, then everybody needed to make a record like yesterday.
Right.
And so now it's just like, oh, how fast can we make a record? So now I'm scrambling to get, you know, I've fallen into some production world now, you know, which is kind of funny too, but it's got me really busy. So hopefully, you know, but hopefully everybody will get back at it. I mean, I don't take it for granted because I know a lot of people in our business are struggling and I hope that they get to, you know, hit one out of the park here too soon.
Yeah, I agree. The temperature of the scene has been insane and it has been, it's been a reactionary response, you know, instead of, oh, we're going to work on this record for 6 months. No, we need it now.
Like,
things are happening.
They have to have something to tour on. So,
dude, but insane. It's good.
We're busy and everybody's healthy and happy. So how about you?
Everybody good. Yeah, everybody seems to be okay. My wife is a school teacher, so she's been miserable for the past year.
Take her to the beach or something before it's too hot.
Oh man, it's already got a farmer's tan. Like it's already there, you know.
Same here,
dude. It's global warming. Fuck me. But man, speaking of your year, it is literally insane. I mean, congrats on Neon Texas and Marfa Tapes.
Thanks, man. Thank you,
dude. Yeah, it's huge.
It kind of all landed at the same time, and I appreciate you saying so, man. It's been a funny journey, you know, like we said, the last couple of years for all of us. But I feel like, you know, if anything great came out of, I say great, if anything positive for myself came out of all the quarantine time, was to be able to actually make this record with Miranda and Jack as well. You know, that I don't know that we would have had a chance to make that and put it out if everybody was on the normal schedules. And that in turn allowed me a little permission to go ahead and put this record out that I've been sitting on for a while. So I've been so busy helping everybody else make records.
Right.
But I haven't had a chance to really focus on finishing this project. So it was good that I was able to do that. And I have kind of felt like I had a little permission to get to do that now.
Yeah. Permission, man. That's a unique word, because I mean, I know a little bit of your story and everything. So to give yourself permission to do something for yourself, I mean, that means something. I mean, Neon Texas, has it been, I don't know, it's been over a decade since your last thing.
I'm trying to think, what was that, 2005 maybe?
Okay, so about over 15.
2005, so yeah, it was a while. And that's what's so funny. A buddy of mine texted me the other day, because this Marfa Tapes record is out on, it's Miranda's label, but it's Sony as well.
Right, you know? Man.
And he pointed out, he goes, you realize this is the third time you've had a deal on Sony. Because I was there in 95 and I was there in 2005 and I'm there again in 2021. So they'll get to drop me a third time.
That does something to your ego. I don't know. To me, that's like a middle finger. A little bit of like, I'm back.
I'm back. Hey, guys. Sorry. Can't get rid of me.
Oh, that's good. Yeah, man. I mean, this 2021 has been your year for sure. I mean, your output, your music, man. It's the Streets of Dallas. Is that what I always mess up song titles?
Streets of Dallas. Yeah,
dude, Streets of Dallas. That's the song for me on your project.
Man, thank you so much. You know, that song came about. You'll appreciate this. I was doing, I think it's been years back, but I was doing, and that song's a little older, but I was doing I forget what, it might've been a leadership music thing or something, but Tom Schuyler came in and gave a whole spiel about co-writing and kind of was talking about how it's ruined the artistic freedom of writing songs, like kind of gave.
Oh, wow.
And it kind of freaked me out a little bit.
Right.
I used to only write by myself.
Here, like, I am.
And I was like, wait a minute, wait, you know, when's the last time I really wrote a song by myself? And that came out of that. It's like, okay, dig inside yourself and think about, you know, something from your childhood or whatever. And I just started thinking about how, you know, when Dallas went through the big oil crash when I was a kid, and just, you know, my dad was a police officer and I used to go downtown with him all the time. And it was just kind of a ghost town, you know?
Right.
So it was fun, just from writer to writer. It was just fun to kind of dig that out and know that that was one of those songs that I'm not pitching this for the next, you know, mainstream radio record. This is not
right.
That kind of song.
Yeah. Who else is from Dallas? Like, you know, like who else would want to own that?
Yeah. Song, and who would put it on radio, you know, or put it on record. So, I mean, it could be the 10th track art piece, you know?
Yeah. I'm artsy.
I always get the 10th track. That's the name of my last public account, is 10th track music. I get the art piece with the 10-minute solo at the end. Or the string.
Hey, man, you're winning. Dude, a cut is a cut in my book, you know?
I'll take it. I'll take what I can get. But yeah, man, and that's how all these songs in this project were. They were those little nuggets that was like, you know what? This is kind of my theme.
Oh, dude.
needs to be my own deal. So, but yeah, that's kind of how that song came about.
That's insane. Yeah. That's one of my favorite ones. Yeah. All those songs seem really do seem more personal than, you know, like a co-write session, you know? I think I've listened enough to your music to say, oh, he owns these. Like, there's a piece of them in all these other songs, but, I mean, you really own these tracks.
Yeah, I appreciate that, man. Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, I do like writing by myself. What I have found, and you know this, I mean, and most of us did, we were writing songs by ourselves, you know, when I was a kid growing up, my dad wrote songs. And so I kind of thought that's what you were supposed to do. And then when I started getting bands in middle school and high school, I just wrote songs for our bands. They weren't great songs, but they were songs nonetheless, you know,
original
material, whatever. What's ironic about that is then I moved to Nashville to try to be a guitar player and didn't even realize you could make a living writing songs. Like, nobody pulled me off. When I came rolling in from Texas, nobody said, hey, man, you write songs? You know what you should think about doing?
Right.
I was like, no, man, I just want to go hang Station Inn and drink beer and play bluegrass. You know, like that was as far as my dream went, you know?
To me, it was almost like it's the secret way to the lottery. And like, nobody told you. Like, nobody told you the golden road of like, you stay a player, keep playing, but all us songwriters, we'll go over here and do our thing and not tell you anything about it. That's what it always felt like.
I think that's what it was. It's like, hey, don't tell them that they need to be more competition.
We don't need any more of you.
Yeah. So it's funny. So like, I was always writing by myself because I enjoyed writing songs, but I never even thought about anything past that. And honestly, when I started working with Emmy Lou Harris early on after I moved to Nashville, and I'd been on the road with her a couple of years when she asked me, she said, do you write songs at all? And I said, yeah. And I played her a couple of songs I'd written, and she kind of said, that's a really good song. She made me play it.
Oh, wow. Family.
Like, play Paul that song. And so, and we recorded it together. And so that was where it kind of started going, okay, you know, I got the Emmy Lou approval that this is good. So let's keep trying.
That's
to,
all you need.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. I mean, I wouldn't have a career without her.
That's insane. Wow. All right. You got to back up a little bit because I know Dallas. So dad was a cop.
Mm-hmm.
In Dallas, man, you know, we're probably maybe a different generation. I don't know. But when I think about Dallas, I think, oh, man, you survived Dallas. I mean, like, it's a rough area. But there was a time of like, oh, it's Dallas, the TV show. Like, it's like.
Right. Yeah.
A little bit more golden era.
Yeah. I grew up kind of south of there, just inside the Dallas city limits, and went to a school in Duncanville, Texas, which is just south of there. But my dad worked there. My mom worked for the fire department there too. But they also played music. My dad had, and my mom played dobro. My dad played guitar. And we had,
oh, wow.
Every weekend, we were either at a festival or we were at someone's house or they were at our house. And like, it was just a constant on the weekends to have musicians hanging around. So I kind of came up just watching my dad do it, you know, he was in bands and they go play festivals and stuff. So
those little Texas Opry's, I mean, they're like everywhere in that area.
Oh yeah. Mesquite Opry, Grapevine Opry. We did all those. Yeah.
Yeah.
Did all those, man.
Yeah, man. And those are great little venues too. Like even in my generation, like there was a time of, this is pretty cool because they're playing at least, you know, some Haggard tunes or whatever. But it was like, I never saw a lot of bluegrass there. Like, did you grow up on bluegrass?
I grew up on bluegrass. So I did all those. There was kind of a scene down there. You know, who was else in that scene was Emily and Marty from the Dixie Chicks.
Yeah.
They had a band, and our band and the Cox family, we all played all these festivals every weekend. And so there was a little bit of a, there still is. There's still a little bit. There's a handful of festivals around there, and it has a little following down there. But that's kind of how me and a handful of my buddies ended up in Nashville, was because, oh gosh, man, I mean, Ricky Skaggs and Sam Bush and Jerry Douglas and Bela Fleck, they all live in Nashville. So, you know, and for me, you know, it also was like, well, Guy Clark lives there, and Townes Van Zandt lives there, and Steve Earle's there, and Rodney Crowell's there. You know, like, it was just kind of like, that's what I thought Nashville was. I wasn't really thinking about, I mean, as big a fan as I was, these guys like, you know, Steve Warner and Haggard and all that, you know, all the mainstream great country stuff that was out.
Right.
That was really what called me to come up here with some buddies.
Man, that's insane. Did you get to write with Guy, or did you just have a song?
Oh,
dude, that's insane.
Yeah, I got to finally, I met him early. I met him when I was like 18, just briefly. We had a really funny story. That's a long story.
This is the place to do it, man.
How I first met him. But but I eventually did, yeah. Eventually got to write some songs with him. He recorded a couple of them, so that was pretty cool.
So how'd you meet him? Like, what's the story?
I was playing, so my very first gig in Nashville was, do you remember Holly Dunn? She had a deal with Warner Brothers. She had a hit called Daddy's Hands.
Mm-hmm. It's that ringing
was,
a bell.
Yeah. She was a Warner Brothers. And that was my very first gig, was playing acoustic guitar and singing harmony. The first thing we did, I'd never been on a plane in my life, and we went to Alaska and Japan on a USO tour. So I'd never been on a plane. For the next 2 weeks, I'm on helicopters and C-130s, and it was insane.
For about 30 hours, all at one time.
Yeah, exactly. Then we turned around, we went to Europe, and we were on this festival in Switzerland, and Guy was on that festival with us. And so was Sonny Curtis and Billy Joe Shaver and all these cats. And so I was hanging out. Somehow I met Guy at like breakfast or something, like you do on those tours, you know. And then I sat and had a cup of coffee with him. We talked about Texas. And he didn't know me from Adam. Poor Adam. He always gets that.
Yeah. He always gets it.
Yeah. But so anyway, somehow I went to watch him play his set. And somehow I ended up with Sonny Curtis. And we're just pounding a bottle of German wine together. And I'm already in over my head because I'm a kid. I'm like 18 years old. I'm just like so in over my head. But I'm trying to hang out with my heroes, you know.
Oh, man.
Cool. So I'm just hammered. And Guy walks off stage, and he just walks right up to me and Sonny. He looks at me and he goes, "Let's go pick." And I go, "Okay, let's go pick." So I grab my guitar and he goes, "Let's go to your room." I'm like, "Okay." So we start heading back to my room. Now, this is back when we were all rooming. So I'm rooming with our drummer, right?
Yeah. Okay.
And by the time we get back into town from the festival, Guy has picked up 20 people, along with Johnny Rodriguez, Billy Joe Shaver, Eddie Shaver, Steve Young, Sonny Curtis. It was this whole thing. We come rolling into the bedroom, and my buddy's, he's in the bed. He's in his underwear. He's in the bed. Guy walks in, flips the lights on, looks at him and goes, "You got to get up. We're going to have to move those beds." And all of a sudden, like, all these people come piling in. Tim gets up. He's trying to get his clothes on. And Guy pushes the beds up against the wall. He picks them up and leans them up against the wall and builds this entire, like, you know, picking
like an
area.
Arena.
Like, right, yeah, like a little picking area. Well, I walk in and immediately go to the balcony and start throwing up off the balcony. Like, I'm in over my, I've made it as far as I can make it.
I can't handle it.
I'm out there dying, just dying through the whole thing. So they end up having this incredible evening. I remember Rodriguez came out at one point, put his arms around me. He goes, "You're going to be okay, kid. You're going to be okay." And I thought, oh God. So anyway, that was the great story. And they had this great night. I missed the whole thing. Well, fast forward, I mean, gosh, 10 years later, maybe not quite 10 years later, but quite a few years later, we were all at Emmy Lou's house for she always had a Super Bowl party. And we're at the Super Bowl party, and Guy and Susanna are there, and we're all sitting on the back deck. They're sitting on the back deck, and I walk up, and I hear Guy telling this story. And it wasn't long after, I think it wasn't long after Eddie Shaver died. So he was kind of reliving the story that Eddie was there and all that. And I'm listening to Guy tell my story from the other side. But the great thing is he doesn't know that's me, right? He didn't know I was there. So he's just telling this story. And then he goes, "And I don't know what happened. That poor son of a bitch threw up off the balcony all night. I don't know whatever happened to him." And I said, "Hey, Guy," I said, "that son of a bitch throwing up on the balcony was me." And he could not believe it. He was so excited about that. He had no idea it was me. He's like, well, oh, no, what happened to you? Isn't that the craziest story?
That is. Oh, it came back around.
Yeah, I was the full circle.
Oh, so good. The my probably most favorite thing about that is like, back then, he knew exactly what he was doing. He said that he was going to your room because he knew that it was going to tear the shit up.
Yeah, yeah. And then he could leave and go to his room. Nobody'd be there. Yeah. He was a pro, man.
That's pro move, man. Pro.
He knew. He knew.
Wow. All right. So, yeah, you got the Nashville. This is about where we're at now.
Right.
You got to play with Holly Dunn. How did that work? Did you audition for that? Or you just knew somebody?
I did. Man, when I first moved to town, I knew one person and it was a buddy of mine from back home. And actually, I take that back. I knew two people. And one was a guy named Richard Bailey that plays in the Steel Drivers now. And he was banjo player in the Steel Drivers. And my buddy Brad that I moved to town with, the week I moved to town, he got a job. He got a road gig. It was one of those last minute things where the guitar player in a band said, screw you guys, I'm out of here, and flew home. And they needed somebody the next day. So I started going to Station Inn every night. And sorry, JT, rest in peace, but they never carted me for whatever reason. And Richard used to run sound down there sometimes. So I would go down there and hang out with him. And I was down there every single night. I would just go to the Station Inn every night. And I would just started meeting everybody in that crew, you know? And so like one time Brent Truitt, he was her band leader. And he was like, hey, somebody told me you play guitar and sing tenor. And I said, well, we're auditioning Friday. We really need somebody. So I did the audition because everybody said, do as many auditions as you can.
Right, that's the thing.
You have to practice auditions. And I went in there and ended up getting the damn gig. I didn't have any gear. I was borrowing gear and flight case. I was not prepared for a real gig. But I ended
up. How long were you in town?
I'd been in town for about, when I got that gig, I'd been in town for about a year and a half, maybe.
Okay. I was about to sympathize with you. Like, I've had gigs, like I moved into town and like, oh, I got to get this pedal. I got to get this. You got this? I had to borrow stuff. But you were in town for a year, man. You could have got that stuff.
Well, I was broke, man. I moved up here because my buddy said that he had a gig for us. So I moved
the promise gig.
It was a big deal. It was going to be a tour, this whole thing.
Right.
And I got here and there was no gig. And I didn't want to just pack up and go right back to Texas because I just got to town. And I literally got a job delivering balloons in a gorilla outfit.
No, that was a real thing in Nashville.
That was the real thing. It was a balloonogram. You'd show up with the happy birthday balloons and you'd go to the hospital in the gorilla outfit sing happy anniversary or happy birthday. That was my first gig, man. That was so crazy.
Sing and dance. You had a shtick with it, I'm sure.
I did that for a few months. I did. It's funny. I did that. And then I worked at a law firm just kind of as a runner. And then I worked at where else did I work? I worked at a sporting goods store. And then I worked at an ad agency as a runner. And then I got a gig at Opryland.
Yeah.
As a rover. Which was actually pretty cool gig.
What is that? What's a rover?
You just walked around the park and played songs and,
Oh, okay. Yeah.
We'd do cruel stuff. Like, everybody get together. Let me have your camera. We'd get everybody together and then we'd take a picture of everybody's feet.
Yeah.
And then they go back to North Carolina, have their film developed, and it'd just be their feet,
Their feet. Oh, if I could ever meet that guy.
I know if I could find that guy. But I did. That was probably the first, it was like the first year I was in town and auditioned for that gig. And I did a summer with her and it was fun. It was the first time I'd been on a tour bus and we went out and did stuff with like Kenny Rogers in Alabama. And, it was
some heavyweights,
some good opening gigs. And then I got that Emmy Lou gig.
Now how'd that happen? Just that happenstance?
Man, I went out and played, it's funny, during that time, I went out and played a couple of gigs with Vince when he was, right before When I'll Call Your Name. He just made that record. Ooh.
Right.
And he was throwing bands together on the weekend. He was just faking it. He was totally just kind of faking it. And I met him at the Station Inn, like I met everybody. And he asked me to go out and play a couple shows, and we did. And then he played a showcase in town, and I met Carl Jackson through him there. And Carl Jackson was, you know, kind of a legend in the bluegrass world and producer, and worked with Dolly and Emmy and Linda and everybody, you know. And I was a big fan of Carl's. So I introduced myself, and he was really, really sweet. Great guy. And he was like, well, man, you know, drop some stuff by my office. All those guys were writing at PolyGram at the time, like him and Cordell and Rushing and all those guys. And he was like, and so I did. I put like this little four track thing down of me singing some songs with the harmonies and flat picking a little bit and whatever. And I dropped it at his office. And man, 2 weeks later, he calls me and he said, man, you forgot to put your phone number on here. I've been looking all over town for you. And he goes, he said, man, Emmy Lou is calling you this week. She's putting together a new band. She wants you to come over and play some songs with her. And so, and then I ended up, and he goes, no, I want you to come sing on our new record. So I went and sang on a record with him and John Starlin that they had just made. And all, and that was the ball rolling. Like then all of a sudden I'm, you know, hanging at Emmy's house, playing songs. Then we had a band rehearsal, and it was a great band of Sam Bush and Roy Husky Jr. and Al Perkins, legendary California rock guy, and Larry Adamanu from C-Train, and he played with Krause and a bunch of people, but it was a hot rod little band, and that was it. And then we played, I toured with her for like 6 years. We made that live at the Ryman record, you know, they were getting ready to tear down the Ryman, and we made Emmy wanted to make a live record there. So that's kind of where it took off. And it was interesting because right out of that, you know, Jim Ed Norman obviously was tight with that whole crew, and they started courting me over at Warner. And then, you know, I was a huge Garth Fundis fan, and Sam introduced me to Garth, and then he was about to sign on at RCA as the head of A&R. So that whole solo artist thing was starting to creep in pretty quick after that.
Right. Right. I can only imagine. All right. This is all perspective for me, because about this time I talked to Sam, he's been on this thing, and he's mentioned that playing with Emmy was probably his favorite years of like playing or performing, because it was like no stress for him. Like the whole new grass thing was over. It was tons of stress off his shoulders. And I would think that there's like a gap missing because Cowan is not doing much at this point. Right. So like they're looking for a tenor guy. They're looking for a tenor vocal artist guy to kind of fill a slot like on a record label. And it just seemed like this golden pony boy, John Randall, just kind of landed in their lap. Is that it?
Maybe, but honestly, man, I think it was, he and I talked about this because it didn't take long to figure out that Vince had just blown up, and you know, I sounded a lot like Vince back then, and not anymore of it back then. And I think that kind of, they're like, well, hey, you know, that's working. Maybe there's room for another guy like that. I think that was probably more of it than anything. I tell you what was fun though, speaking of John Cowan, was during the Emmy days, we put together a set with Sam and John and me and Larry, and we played Telluride here. And then we ended up booking that band toured for about 3 years. And being a ginormous Newgrass Revival fan,
right,
that was the most fun I ever had. And Emmy, obviously, I cut my teeth and learned everything, you know, with Emmy.
I mean, dude, you're in it. Like, if there's a, like, I don't know, Mount Rushmore bluegrass, like, dude, you're in it. That's insane.
Yeah, I mean, it was like, I was a giant Newgrass fan. I still have every record. I still listen to those records. But
they're so good.
But, yeah, it was great getting to play in that band. And, you know, and then you go play those festivals, and Baylor would jump up, and we'd do, like, a couple of Newgrass songs. We'd be calling Baton Rouge, and we'd do all that. And it was just like, I was smiling from ear to ear on those gigs, you know.
Oh, man.
It was so much fun to tour with those guys.
Blazing through some of those Tony Rice chops. Did you ever meet Tony? Especially hanging out with Emmy Lou? Yeah.
I did. I met Tony. You'll appreciate this as a guitar player. We played a gig. It was like the first year with the Nash Ramblers. And and we played this festival. I cannot remember where, but Tony played right before us, which was horrifying.
Yeah.
Because I did not want to have to go on stage, you know. And I was a kid, man. I mean, I was really green. And so
that's the equivalent of like Jimi Hendrix lighting his guitar on fire. Like, who wants to go on after that?
I mean, yeah, I mean, seriously, you know. So anyway, I get up there and Tony watches the whole show and I'm just falling apart because I know he's standing on the side of the stage. That's just a train wreck. But anyway, we get off stage and there's these two dressing rooms in the back. And between the dressing room, there's a wall, but there's a gap about this wide, you know, maybe not quite a foot wide at the top. So I can hear in the next dressing room. And I hear Tony in there talking to Sam. He goes, hey, Sam, who's that kid playing guitar with you guys? And everybody called me Randy growing up. Sam knew his Randy. His name's Randy Stewart. I used to know his dad. Me and Courtney used to go play music with his dad. But he's in Nashville now, blah, blah, blah. He kind of gave me the story. And Tony goes, man, I dig his playing. And man, my chest just swelled up. And then Sam goes, well, yeah, he's trying to play all your licks. And he goes, I know, that's what I'm talking about. So there you go. It's kind of a left-handed compliment there, you know?
Oh, he just backhanded you.
Yeah, just totally. Like, I was feeling so cocky for about a millisecond.
Oh, the Jimi Hendrix of bluegrass. And yeah. All of a sudden, he just kind of bitch slaps you with a compliment.
Yeah, it was so great. But I did get to know Tony. We did this thing called the Jamgrass Tour one year when I was with Sam. And it was like 10 or 15 of the band, Grisman and Younger Mountain Stream and all those guys.
Oh, man.
And I got to hang out with Tony on that. He was fun. He was an interesting cat, man. He talked with all that jazz lingo. All my guitar buddies are probably sick of hearing me tell the story. So if they're listening, I apologize for telling it again. But we were standing on the side of the stage and I bought this D35 to take out. It's like a Rogue guitar, you know, because I was plugging up and stuff. And we were loud. We weren't really bluegrass. We were pretty loud. And I was standing there kind of getting ready to walk out. And Tony goes, man, that's a good sounding box for a D35. And I was like, yeah, it's not bad. I said, I'm about to go plug it up and make it sound just like a Takamine. And he goes, well, you know, when I was with J.D. Crow, we were the first cats to use transducers on our axes.
He would be the one to throw that at you.
He calls it a transducer. I hadn't heard that. I mean, we were the first cats to use transducers in our axes. Like, I was it's like, I want to talk like that for real. Like, that's so badass.
I'm Tony so Rice. Did I say transducer?
Transducers.
It's 1983. Thanks, Tony.
Dude, absolutely. So great. So great, man.
Oh, well. Man, what an insane. And, dude, you had to be early 20s. Like, all this was happening for you.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
You play with Emmy at this time, and she liked your song, and you start talking like record deal.
Yeah.
Bro, were you a jerk back then? Because I feel like your ego would have to be so massive.
I don't know. You'd have to talk to people that knew me back then. I know I was painfully immature, you know.
Yeah, I think I would have been too.
I think I was really in over my head. And luckily I had people around me kind of, you know, keeping an eye on me because I was wide open, man.
Bro, I mean, that's just it. This Texas kid moves into town. It just seems like everything just happened so quick, like all of a sudden.
Yeah, it really kind of did. Looking back, it was like, you know, it was just one little thing led to the next thing, you know. And then it's a roller coaster. It had its crash and burn moments, several, you know.
I gotta ask this before we get into like some of those crash moments. But yeah, you got a Grammy from the live record.
Uh-huh.
Do you get the paper or do you get the statue?
We got the statue. Sam and I got to statue. Go get it because Emmy couldn't get it at the show. So Sam and I actually went and accepted it, you know. And it's like, but it was one of those deals where on live television, it's like earlier tonight, awards were given to these two hillbillies.
Yeah.
You know, in a category you don't care about. And then you move on. It's a picture of me and him with our long hair, you know, beards.
With a mullet? Did you have a mullet?
Oh, dude, I had a beautiful mullet.
I love it, man.
I had a beautiful mullet.
Yeah, I love talking. Who had that story? It was Moose. Moose was talking about when they wrote 5 o'clock somewhere, and they got the Grammy or whatever that night, and yeah. they're on the red carpet, and you know, like there's just publicists. Like, do you want to talk to this person? Do you want to talk to this person? And they got to one reporter and they said they just won country song in the year, and the reporter's like, yeah, I guess.
Well, I remember when I can't remember exactly, so I apologize if I'm wrong, but I know it was Sam and Edgar Meyer. I want to say it was either that Yo-Yo Ma and Joshua Bell thing, or it was Bela and Jerry. It was one of those in that group, like
right, yeah.
around that era. And Rosie O'Donnell said, comes back from commercial break and says, and now here's four guys you've never heard of. That was the introduction.
Well,
like, wow, really? Don't even get to say our names.
We don't even get that.
So funny, dude.
Oh man. And it was Rosie. She probably had that long. I remember one time she had like a long whisker or something. That was a thing. Like it was a joke for her.
The joke so for this, had the big whisker.
This is long whisker, and this is introducing you. Oh, your life. That's insane. Okay. Yeah. What do you do with the statue? I ask everybody this. Like, do you have it on display? Do you use it as a tangible speaker?
I was an idiot. You got to remember how young I was. I lived in an apartment over in Donaldson. And so I put it on the back of the commode because I wanted to make sure everybody saw it. If you're over at my house for a party, I wanted to make sure you saw it. You know, didn't put it in a place. It was like, I want you to. And I have another buddy that does that at his studio. If you go in, it's sitting on the back of the commode. It's like, yep.
Best placement.
Yeah. That way nobody misses it, you know?
Yeah. I've heard Doorstop, Brandon Bell uses his as a speaker. Like he had a speaker in it.
Yeah. That's so funny. I love Brandon.
I do too, so, man. You guys had a long relationship. When did you meet him?
Man, I met him when I started working with Gary Pachoza. I guess we really met. We may have met before, but we really like became friends and started working together a lot on the Up on the Ridge record that I produced for Dirks.
Yeah.
I did that with Pachoza, and he was Gary's assistant during that time. So we spent a lot of hours together. And then we worked on a handful of records after that.
Right, right. Dude, that Bentley record, man, it is so good. It's one of my top three. I love Dirks. Like, I can't say that a lot, like a lot about a lot of people, but man, Dirks Bentley, like he's one of my top favorite country artists.
Me too, man. He's so good. He's such a good cat. He's a great writer and he's a great entertainer, you know. He's one of those guys, you know, it's like I met him before he had a deal. And actually Jesse really got to know him more than I did before he had a deal. We just kind of ran in some of the same circles and didn't really hang much, but he's one of those guys that, and you've seen this in this town too, but everybody's rooting for a guy like that.
Oh, 100%.
Because you're such a good dude and you're working so hard and you're trying so hard and you have so much respect for everyone around you that it's like, those are the people that everybody in this town wants to elevate. You know?
Yeah, so please. This be the guy.
He deserves every bit of success he's had.
Yeah, I've never hung out with him, but I hung out with Jim Beavers. He says the same thing. Yeah. So, I mean, it's in the water, man. Like, everybody talks. That's the thing about this town. Everybody talks about everybody.
Yeah. And good and bad.
Good and
oh my gosh.
Well, and that's why I asked about the jerk question, because I always like to get to know a person, because I've never heard a bad thing about you, but I just feel like being like a 20-year-old, you're hot snot, man. You start getting a record deal. When that record come out? It was 95? Is that what I got? What, you don't know?
Yeah. Yeah. That would have been 95.
Yeah. So you signed a deal and this was the thing. Now you're starting to, did you ever want to be an artist? I mean, you said you didn't know what songwriter was and you just came to be a side guy, but now you're an artist.
Now you're an artist. Yeah. Well, I mean, I don't know, man. That's always such a great question. It's like, yes, I was like every other young kid, you know, I wanted to be Elvis. We all wanted to be Elvis, right? You know, we all wanted to, I wanted to be Tony Ross. And so it was like, I didn't really have a goal of like, okay, I want to go be an arena act and here's how I'm going to do it. I'm going to brand myself. And I'm like, you know, like right, I kind of was so in over my head and so green that I just didn't really know. And when somebody goes, hey man, you should sign a record deal, you know, and do.
So you were just along for the ride? I mean,
I was kind of along for the ride, man. I really was. I was, and I, maybe to probably to a fault, trusted some people around me, you know, that I felt like they knew what they were doing. And then, you know,
right
now I realize if anybody in this town tells you, know, they know what they're doing, they're lying.
Yeah. It's a snake. Man. It's a scam shit. Already.
Yeah. It's a scam already. If you, I can tell you everything not to do.
Right. Yeah.
But I can't tell you, I know what to do, you know? Yeah. So, but yeah, I don't know. It's a good question. I don't think I was a jerk at all. I don't even think I was really cocky. I was actually probably really insecure because I was so in over my head, you know. I used to have tremendous stage fright. Like
I did too.
Debilitating stage fright.
Yeah, I had to. I learned this trick in college. Like something like potassium does something with the. Is it serotonin, like the fear element or anger or something? Like it balances out. And so every time before I got on stage, I ate a banana because it was like that debilitating. I just couldn't do it.
I wish I'd known that because I drank a half a bottle of whiskey before I went on stage and a banana the was worst. so much healthier. A friend of mine turned me on to Enderol or propanolol. Yeah. And I found out that half of my heroes have been taking that stuff for years. It doesn't do anything, but it's a beta blocker, I guess they call it. It doesn't do anything but regulate your heart rate so your adrenaline doesn't get you to that shaky.
Yeah, you tense up.
And your voice goes this thing. And once I found that and I just take like 20 milligrams of that, it's so much more fun to play music.
Oh, dude.
But it was years before I found that out. So for years, man, I'm just like pounding, you know, some drinks before the show. And that's sometimes that's fun, and in the right setting, that's fun. But I look back at some shows that I go, man, I wish I hadn't had a buzz on for that.
Oh, wow.
Because I kind of really missed it a little bit, you know?
Like that moment, like whatever, like a highlight. It could have been a highlight, a more vivid highlight now.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, I think you have to pick and choose when the crowd's there to party with you or not. You know, it's like people don't buy a ticket to come watch you get drunk and be a dick, you know?
I don't know, man. Depends on the show. I don't know.
I mean, I've been at those shows, so maybe they do. But for me, I was really glad to find that because it really helped me. I kind of wish I'd had it back then because I'd be curious to know if my stage presence and my, you know, taste on stage would have been different, you know?
Yeah, I mean, there is something to that, right? Because you could look at like maybe like an Aaron Lewis, like that's what everybody expects to be like to see that Aaron Lewis guy. You're going to get cussed out. Somebody's going to get punched, something.
Yeah.
Or it's like this humility character on stage. Like the character on stage is something fascinating in my brain because even as a side guy and even frontman, some of my other stuff, it's like, yeah, what character is this thing going to be? You try to be yourself, but you're never yourself. Like you end up being something else.
Right. Yeah. Well, and you kind of feed off your audience too.
Right.
You know, it's like when your audience is super responsive, there's nothing like when you realize you're clicking on all cylinders, man, you're having an honest conversation. You're not being sticky. You're not saying the same thing you said last night. Like you're free flowing a conversation with the crowd, but they're responding. And those are the best nights, man. You feel like, you know, oh man, I made them laugh. I made them cry. You know, I made them think and they listened.
You make them feel.
We had this experience together, you know?
Yeah. It's that feeling. I think that's what I gravitate towards songwriting a lot more because it really felt like, I guess an artist can manipulate that live, but the songwriter can like produce that emotion. Like that's where that emotion comes from. That's what always gravitated me towards songwriting.
Yeah.
Like for you. I mean, what is that for you, like for songwriting? Is it kind of the same thing?
Yeah, it is. I mean, it's been such a journey for songwriting because, like we said, I grew up doing it. It started as necessity. Then it started as I'm really starting to feel some things I want to say as I got older, trying to find what that was, you know, and then it became a job. And then it was like your co-writer. Now, okay, what's the – and the part of the job that I do like of it is – especially when there's a goal, when there's an artist that wants to say something, you know?
Yeah.
Or when like yesterday I wrote with an Americana artist, today I'm writing with a pop artist, tomorrow I'm writing, like getting to spread that out a little bit keeps it interesting. But just as a solo writer, man, for me, it's like, yeah, I'm just trying to find something, a story that connects with people, right?
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
And trying to be a storyteller.
Yeah, that's what I've always loved about your writing. And I mean, Towns is the same way. Guy was the same thing. It was all story stuff. Maybe there was a piece of their life in it that kind of made it, mm-hmm. you know, that more tangible feeling. Right. But at the same time, like, it's a lot of fictional writing, you know?
Yeah, it's funny. I had a song that I played Guy early on when we first started hanging out, and I went to his house to write. Guy would always do this. He'd go, play me some.
Yeah.
I played this song that I wrote. And he absolutely flipped out over this song, like loved the song. As a matter of fact, he got it recorded for me. Like he picked, like if he found a song that he believed in, it wasn't that he didn't write, he would act like he wrote it. It was this really sad song, you know, and about this guy, and he ends up killing himself. One of those great songs, you know. I love the death songs.
Murder ballads, murder songs. Oh, it's so good.
So, but what was interesting was, somewhere in the translation, I guess God meant, so years later, we were playing this thing and this little round, and actually it was one of those deals where Guy took over the bar we were hanging out at and turned it into a show. That was the deal. Made him turn the music off. So go get your guitar. So here we go. And anyway, he tells everybody, gives it this huge thing. He's like, here's a song about, you know, best song since Sunday Morning Coming Down. Here's, you got to listen to this. Y'all see the real word of this song. And he would sell that song that way. Well, one day he was telling somebody, man, you got to hear this song that Randy wrote about this friend of his, man, that showed up at his house one night and then went and killed himself. And I was like, yeah, that's not, no, I just, like, he was like,
whoa,
what?
Whoa, whoa.
No, he was like, I've told everybody this song's a real true song. I was like, he goes, well, now I don't like it as much. I thought it was a true song. I was like, no, I was just doing what you do. I was just making shit up, man. Like,
right.
Isn't that what we do? Like, we write stories, you know?
Then right.
We're not always right, you know? So that was so funny, though, that he was sure that was a true story, you know?
Oh, he believed it. He believed it so much. He spread the good word. I mean, do you find that, like, I know in some of the stuff, well, I haven't written with somebody in a long time, but when I did, it was like, nobody was really interested, like, in the story song, you know? Like, nobody was interested in I Shot a Man in Reno. Like, and the thing I always loved about your writing, and I hang out with publishers, too, they're just like, don't put cigarette in your song. There's no more suicide.
Yeah, right. Yeah. I know.
You hear all these rules, you know? And I'm looking at John Randall and Whiskey Lullaby. I'm like, dude, that's, like, the trifecta of, like, every broken rule.
Hey, and because of that, I was sure no one would ever record that song. Bill Anderson called me and said, hey, man, I'm over at the fire hall. I want to demo that song. And I go, oh, Bill, man, that place, it's a 4.5-minute double suicide, but nobody's going to record that song. You know?
That's a tough sell. Here.
And we did. And, you know, and it's, I mean, that story is such its own journey, too. You know, it's kind of fluke to fluke to fluke. But, you know, but that's the crazy thing, too, about songs, man. You never know. And it's always, I know you know this too. It's like your publisher calls and goes, hey, so-and-so is cutting this song. You're like, where the hell did they hear that song? Like, what about these 10 songs that are like right down the middle for them? You know?
Right.
It's like they found some random song out of an old catalog, you know? And you're like, oh,
right.
Okay. Yeah, man. Awesome.
Yeah.
Take what we can get.
I would think from that perspective, like when you see Whiskey Lullaby, because that's the first thing that you see, it's like, oh, well, what could this be? What is that thing? I mean, this sounds right up a country alley. But then when you listen to it, it's like, oh, it's right in the lane of bluegrass. And then you start to wonder of like, oh, is this a true story? Like, is this a true thing?
And
it's like, no, it comes from, I know where the song comes from, and it's a dark time in your life. That's a little bit of the inspiration. But man, like those songs just aren't there for me. Like anymore, you know, like I feel like less and less people want to write like the story driven songs.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, I think we've gone away from that a little bit. And it's, I think a lot of too, you know, I mean, it's all the different influences and it's, you know, it's what it is. Mm-hmm. I'm not complaining, but what I've ran into is some artists are either scared to tell a real story. They don't, you know, there's a little bit of, they branded themselves. Branding's the new key phrase, and they branded themselves into this thing that they can't step outside of. And so, you know, or I, you know, there was a song I had, it's like, well, I can't do that because, you know, my dad didn't drink or whatever. And it's like,
right,
I know. And Tom Cruise isn't really a spy, but he sure makes you think he's one when you're watching him on a movie, you know, like,
right.
we have a little bit of a leeway to get to, you know, be that. But I think people have gotten away from that a little bit, you know, or as far as when they're really worrying about the hit and the mainstream of that.
Right, right. I think a large part of that, I don't know, opinion maybe, is that, yeah, it's the whole brand aspect, but then why not? There's so many fictitious things in our lives. Like, I know Game of Thrones isn't a real fucking show. Like, why can't we write like a badass song around this murder ballad?
Yeah.
Because this pattern has existed. It does have a recipe for quote unquote success, but nobody wants to touch it because they never murdered. They never murdered their wife.
Nobody in music row, you know?
Right. Right.
In other genres, it's so wide open, you know, when we're just talking about, you know, for your listeners, like what we're talking about right now is the whole staff write, music row, going for country radio thing. And I think probably one of the most, and look, I've had a couple of hit songs, not a lot, but I've had a few hit songs, and it's a great thing. And I'm not pissing on it at all. I'm blessed and I appreciate everything I've had. But I think there was an enlightening moment that was kind of actually kind of a depressing moment, realization, I guess would be, when I kind of realized, especially when I was doing radio tours, you know, and I did a lot, because you remember that was the deal. And I had I made like five major records. For every single off those records. And it was grueling. I did that more than I ever played music as an artist, was just go out and visit radio for a year leading up to trying to get a single out. And I think what was kind of disheartening was realizing we are the filler. Those songs are the fillers between the commercials. You know, they don't want you. It's almost like talk radio. You don't really listen to it. It's just not.
It's just
they
noise.
Don't
yeah,
want
yeah.
people to have to listen too hard or think too much. They just want to keep the party alive to get them to work, to get to the next Geico commercial. So, you know, and that's kind of a realization that we all have to look at is go, that's what we fight sometimes. That's why when great songs do break through, you know, those really, the ones that end up being songs of the year, you know, you go, okay, those can still work, but somebody has to be brave enough to put them out there. I mean, you know this too, there's always on every record I've made, every record I've produced, there's always one song that's blatantly the best song on the whole record.
Oh yeah,
everybody loves it. And inevitably, everyone will talk themselves out of releasing it.
Yeah. But,
you know what I'm saying?
Like
they'll know it's the best song on the record, but every now and then they just balls up and they throw it out there and it's usually huge. And then everybody stands around going, well, it was a fluke. You know, it's just such a weird, it's weird. I've noticed too, like, especially just, you know, in the same genre we're talking about, you know, in the whole music growth thing, people are not listening. I've noticed when I play, turn in records and play things, people are not listening to songs to decide. They don't listen and go, man, I love that. I love that chorus. Man, that I can't quit singing that melody. It's what's wrong with it.
Right.
They listen to figure out what is wrong with it. It's like that girlfriend that wants to pick a fight and is looking for anything you say in the entire day. What's the one thing you did wrong that day?
Right.
That's what we're going to talk about the rest of the night. It's like, okay, well, that one line in the bridge just, you know, the demographic between 25 and 30 year old women that have kids.
Oh, man. That line, you're killing me now.
Yeah, but you know what I'm saying? It's just such it's a weird way to listen to music. And I just go, I don't think our fans listen to music like that.
No, like, you know? Who does? Like, it's hard for me to, like, like, I don't think Becky on the other side, take your kid to soccer, is really just kind of thinking, oh, he said cigarette. I don't think I'm going to let my kids listen to the song anymore, or whiskey or whatever. And so, like, when a publisher says that, or I don't know, anything all above, these rules and demographics, it's hard to wrap my head around that as a creative songwriter. But I feel like that's what you got to think of as a producer too. Right.
Mm-hmm.
Like when you put on that producer hat, you got to like kind of think, oh, this will play on country radio. That's what I'm shooting for. But the songwriter hat is a little bit different. Right.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, and it's in, I mean, it, as you know, it's like, and you do too, but it's like, I live in so many different genres of music.
Right.
That it's almost a weird dance that I'm always doing, you know? And I love it. I love wearing all these hats, but it's kind of like, I told somebody the other day, I said, I'm still trying to figure out what I want to do when I grow up. You know, I don't know.
We're looking in the mirror right now.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know what I want to do when I grow up. You know, it's like, okay, I want to play this kind of music. No, I want to play this kind of music. No, I'm going to produce this kind of record. But I feel like, you know, it's what I've come to learn within myself. Whatever. It's funny because Jack Ingram laughs at me. I always say I'm not a producer. I'm a facilitator. And Dirks has titled me the professional wingman. It's like, I can help somebody chase something down that they want or whatever's in the moment. So as a songwriter, if we're co-writing, I kind of wait to see what hat am I supposed to be wearing, you know? Am I just going to be lyric guy just throwing lyrics, you know? Or do I need to grab the guitar and start hitting some melody ideas, you know? Like, and where are we going with this idea? You know, what is the goal and who's the artist and what's the genre and how are we going to chase this, you know? And I feel that way with making records too. It's like, you know, working on, you know, Dirks' commercial record, Burning Man, is not anything like the record I'm making with Jack Ingram at Arlen Studio live with Charlie Sexton, you know.
Right.
I have to completely change what I do. But I feel like one thing that I learned from working with a couple of really legendary producers that I got to come up under was especially George Massenberg. You know, there's a lot of producers that it's kind of their record, and there's nothing wrong with that.
It's their stamp, it's their brand.
If you're a producer that has an incredible sound, incredible style, people want to go do that. Just like people want to go to muscle shows and make records. You know, they want to go, I want to go get that Miami sound, that Memphis sound, New Orleans. I want to make that record in New Orleans, you know. And producers dial in their thing. I want to make a record with so-and-so and I get so and so. But when I was working with George Massenberg as an artist, there was a couple times and I really soaked this in from him because I would want to chase something and he would go, I absolutely don't get it. I don't hear it. I don't think it's going to work, but he'd say, but let's try it and let's chase it and let's go. So I've learned to kind of do that through that is to go, okay, I don't exactly know what you're talking about. You want to do here, but let's go down that road and see where it gets us, you know? And almost, I want to find it. I want to find what you're talking about. I want to make what you're hearing work, you know? And a lot of times it's what neither one of us were thinking and it goes into some fantastic place. That's the great thing about collaborating with great musicians and engineers and having so many creative people in our rooms. A lot of times it takes on a life of its own. And then conceptually you've built this record that nobody even saw coming, you know?
Right. In this context, and even throw in some hindsight, do you regret being an artist, like doing the record label situation, being the artist thing? Because I feel like in this context, like people are just kind of telling you what to do. But if you just opted to be the songwriter, producer, you get to grow and choose and make your own path along the way, which, I mean, it's not Back to the Future. You can't go back in the past and change anything, but are there any regrets to the artist thing?
It is interesting because it's like there are regrets, but then you go, but what would have happened? Would I have been here now? I mean, it's hard to, you know, there was a time where when I was touring with Lyle Lovett, I was living back in Texas and I wanted to move back to Texas and I still want to move back to Texas and I'm going to move back to Texas at some point, but it's like, but I would have never met Jesse. There's a possibility I would, or I wouldn't have stayed here to have that. So yes, the journey is the journey and you have to respect it. I had one moment where I'd made two records for RCA as an artist and neither one of them really came out. The first one was kind of released. The second one never came out. Great Day to Be Alive.
Shelved it.
Great Day to Be Alive was the name of the album. It was going to be the next single. And they said, they're like, well, we can never get that played at radio. So we all knew it was a good song. Way to go, Travis. Right. I love Travis. Yeah. Go for it, buddy.
Get it, man.
But I wasn't Travis Tritt either. And so who knows how that would have landed too, you know.
was the label drop? It was RCA, right?
Yeah.
Was that okay? So was it? Oh shit! Now I forgot the president's name. Joe Galante. So when he popped in, I mean, dude, he's a Frenchman out of guillotine. He just chops away. He's been on the thing. He and I talked like he's so intimidating.
Yeah.
And now,
he didn't sign me.
Okay.
And so, and I love Joe. I have a letter somewhere that he wrote me when he got that's just beautiful letter. Really kind, very kind letter. But, and he was, it's funny, man. He was right. I wasn't a star. I was a good artist and I was talented, all that stuff, but I didn't have that thing. And I was also fighting the Vince Gill comparisons. And so when he came back, it's like, he just didn't get it. He would have never signed me in the first place. So in hindsight, I kind of get what he was saying.
But bro, that's a tough pill to swallow though.
Yeah. But it's like knowing what I know now. Mm-hmm. And I look, and here's the thing too, knowing how immature and insecure I was then, I would have probably been a wreck. You know, I might have had one hit and then I'd be playing some cowboy club in South Texas tonight playing
right
that one hit. And God bless the cats that do it, you know.
Right.
God bless you that pulled it off and can do it. But you know, I look back and go, well, you know, maybe that was part of the reason for that. But there was a moment where Asylum Records approached me to come over there. They just had a new regime and they had tons of money and it was big doings over there. And but Steve Earle wanted to sign me to his label, his E Square label, which was a Warner imprint. And he wanted to make a record on me. He was like, man, I just love seeing you with the Masked Ramblers when you would do that thing with Emmy and you guys were, you know, when you'd sing lead and you had that band. He's like, I just think you could carry that sound forward. She's not doing that anymore. And that's a thing that you could continue on with, you know? And I wish I had done that, honestly, because I signed this deal. Asylum threw a ton of money at me, and I'm 26 years old, and I'm like, you know, looking at this giant check, and I'm, you know, I'm a musician, you know, that has had no hits. I've been doing radio tours. I haven't even been playing gigs. I'm broke, you know? So I took the check, and then that they went out of business before the record even came out. And then life moves forward from there, you know. But I kind of wish I'd listened to him. But had I, then everything would probably be different. I may be out there playing the festivals, which I'd love. I would love that career, you know. I might be out playing Telluride and Merle Fest and all that with some cool funky band and collaborating with all my peeps. But that's just not the way it went, you know.
Right. This is the story, and this is it.
Yeah.
Wow, that's insane, man. Yeah, I would have taken that deal too. They probably went under because they paid you so much.
Yeah, right. Yeah. There was so much money back then.
So much money. How much did they pay you?
They gave me $75,000 non-recoupable.
Right.
I'm 26 years old in 1995.
Right.
Yeah. Like, I mean, I know it's not the $1 million deals, but man, for a kid out of South Dallas, I was like, okay. I'll take it. And plus, but the crazy thing is, think about this, man. Like when I signed RCA as a brand new artist, my first album budget was like $350,000. Like
that's
they
insane,
had
bro.
So much money back then. And for people that don't know that are listening, that was a lot of that. They don't do that with now. People don't make $350,000 records. Like they had, everybody was making so much money. Everybody was selling platinum. I mean, if you sold gold, you got dropped.
Right.
Literally, they were dropping people for only selling 500,000 records.
Right. But man, like looking at your career, you're one of the greats. Whiskey Lullaby is going to be one of those greats. It is one of those greats. It's definitely in the catalog, one of the greatest country songs ever written.
I appreciate it, man. I do. For anybody that's coming up in the business and trying to figure it out, you just have no idea what a random journey that was. That song, we recorded a demo of it, and we wrote it in 1998. We recorded a demo on it. It got passed around. People would go, I heard that song. It would get put on hold, but, you know, never would get recorded. Bill Anderson was over in the early 2000s. Bill was over at Brad's company. He was going to write with Brad that day. They were hanging out. And Lizzo Sullivan said, was talking to Bill in the lobby. And she said, you and John Randall wrote one of my favorite songs I've ever heard. He goes, oh, which one? She said, the song called Whiskey Lullaby. And he talked about it. Brad goes, was there, and he goes, well, I want to hear it. She had it right there. She threw it in. It's back in the CD days. Threw it in, played it. And Brad goes, well, man, I want to cut that. I'm recording that. I mean, come on, man. So it was his idea to put Alison Krauss on it. He and Frank Rogers, they put Alison on it. And it was a deep track. And Galani had actually submitted it because it wasn't going to be a single, but he submitted it for a Grammy the year before, trying to get that, play the Alison Krauss card, you know, and it didn't get nominated. So they were down to, this is a crazy story, and you can do some more research on this, but they printed some Billboard. When I signed my deal with Sony Records, I grew up with Emily Marty from the Dixies. We grew up playing bluegrass together, and I was like, well, you know, if it's not going to be a single, I might want to record it. Maybe I can get, I'd open some dates for them. And I was like, maybe I could get them to sing on it. We could do our own thing on it. John Grady thought that was a great idea because he'd just taken up Sony. And he was like, I'd love to have an olive branch because they had this big falling out, you know, with the previous presidents. He was like, this would be great if we could do this. My publisher calls Renee Bell, says, hey, Renee, what's going on with and this is when the merger is happening between those two companies. What's going on with Whiskey Lullaby? And she was like, she goes, well, I don't know. I think they come with another single, and I don't know if they'll go five for this one or not. You know, everybody loves it, but I don't know. And Ree said, well, JR's getting ready to cut it with the Dixie Chicks, which was not true.
Yeah,
I didn't call them.
You played the bluff.
Renee said she walked right down to Joe's office and said, if they record this, and this is a big song, this is going to be bad.
It's going to be a regret.
You got to look at this again. So, right. So they rethought that whole thing and ended up putting it out. Now, that's the story I read in Billboard, and that's the way I know it. I'm sure other people have different ideas on that. But that's kind of, it was just this random. There was a little bit of play. There was a little bit of politics, maybe. I don't know.
I call it Game of Thrones. That's what it was.
And then they were not going to put out a video. But Sean LaPlume, easy for me to say.
Yeah, it's a tough one.
Sean was hanging out with Ricky Schroeder, and he was talking about, he was asking her how videos are done. She was explaining how you write a treatment and all that. And she goes, well, they're not going to make a video on this song. Do a video, you know, write a treatment for it. He wrote a treatment. She loved it, took it to Joe, and Joe went, well, we got to do it. So it was all just kind of like, and I'm just saying that for your, you know, if there's people listening that are up and coming, just hang in there, man, because it'll be one you didn't see. You'll be trying over here, and it'll be something you didn't see coming at all.
Oh, that's insane.
That'll move to the next thing, you know?
Right. Yeah, from my knowledge, that song never went like number one, right?
Yeah, it made it to two.
Made it to two. Who was number one? Do you even remember?
Well, I'm trying to remember the songs. Live Like You Were Dying.
Oh, yeah.
Was up there. And it was which was a great song. Live Like You Were Dying was number one slot for like 5 weeks.
Right.
We were at two. And I can't remember, but Keith was at three and Chesney was at four, or maybe the other way around. But it was like right there. And then they changed the rules after this. Reba had a song out and she was at seven. And Scott Bruschetta bought a bunch of advertising time. But it counted.
I remember the
spins.
Yes.
She went from seven to number one, knocked the chart backwards, and we lost that. We were moving into number, we were supposed to be number one that week.
Right.
She comes out of the blue, jumps from seven to one, falls off the chart the next week, and then we got jumped over. I want to say Live Like You Were Dying back to one, and then Keith jumped over us. So it only made it to two.
Whoa,
it's what that is. But and here's the other crazy fluke on that, man. It was nominated for 2004 Song of the Year,
mm-hmm.
and Live Like You Were Dying won. And it was nominated again in 2005. And it won.
Yeah. And then it won. Yeah.
I mean, you just fluke, you know? It's just crazy.
Just along for the ride, man.
Yeah, I know, man. Always have been. Just, I have no idea.
And you're back in the saddle. You're doing the artist thing. Like, I mean, no matter how you look at the Marfa tapes, like, you're part of the trio. And, of course, right. You got Neon Texas. You're doing the thing. And you were a little, like, I get the sense, too. Like, I feel that we're related on this. Like, the anxieties of being the thing, you know? Like, being the guy on stage and the artist being the thing. Yeah. That's what makes the trio so much easier, because it's like, well, not all the eyes are on me. Like, we actually get to share it. Is that a little bit part of it in your headspace too?
It's like you can watch everybody else's lips when they're singing the anthem, you know?
Yeah, right.
It's a lot easier with friends. Yeah, it is. I give Miranda grief. I enjoy being the blurry guy on the right. That's what I always say.
Yeah,
that's
nice.
What my book's going to be titled. I'm good over here. It's like, if you make me an artist again, I'm never going to talk to you. Like, you know, what are we doing here? But I don't know, man. She reminds me of Emmy so much, in the fact that Emmy's always been, hey, look at these people. You've never heard of this person. I want you to, she lifts up people around her. She's a fan of other artists and friends. And she's so giving in that way. You know, and I know her deep down that a little bit of this was also, hey, I want you to hear my buddies too. You know, here's a good way for us to do this. And so, and because of that, it kind of, she encouraged me, and I've got a new management team I'm really excited about. And that's weird too, taking on management after 15 years, you know,
right. I mean, it's a whole different ball game, whole different sport,
whole other thing. But, but it's, you know, it's, I guess it's all about timing. It worked out great. And I had people around me that were, including my wife, Jessie, who's, you know, the real rock star in the family. She was the one that was like, you have to finish this record. And everybody's like, yeah, man, put this music out. Just put it out. You know, I don't have any misconceptions about it. You know, it's not like, oh, I got a shot at radio. You know?
Right. Yeah.
It's like, no, but it's kind of cool too, because we do live in a different time where there's no gatekeeper between you and streaming.
Oh, bro. Just put it on the internet and that's it. I mean, you just got to sign up for DistroKid or whatever.
Yeah.
And that's your distribution. Done.
Yeah. There's no red tape between that. So it's, you know, more than anything, you know, I just want to have some music out there. It's something for my kids down the road, and my grandkids down the road can look back and go, oh, yeah, granddad.
Right. Cool. There's never been a unique time. Well, maybe like in the 70s, like I got a Tom T. Hall record here. Like in that time, I feel like the songwriter was celebrated, but I think now more than ever, like the songwriter's like in the forefront. Like it's almost part of artistry. It is part of the thing now.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, it is. And that's, I mean, that's cool. And it's, as you know, man, I mean, get online and look at how many songwriters and music there is out there.
It gives me anxiety. I can't do it.
Yeah, it's a lot. I mean, it's a lot. But that's cool too, because people are finding their fans that way, you know. People are listening and they're going, I really like that. I love how that connects. And so it's cool, man. And, you know, the Marfa tapes is a nice little, put me on the radar of some people that would have never listened, you know, or known, you know, and so I appreciate the opportunity.
Oh, man, you're doing the Lord's work. It's all incredible. It really is. I really don't gush over projects too much, but this is one of them for 2021. Even Neon Texas, man, it's up there too. Like songwriting and like doing your thing. It's nice to hear your voice too. Now you got a little gruff in your voice now, dude.
I've got this new distortion in my voice, and I have to tell, because as soon as I see an engineer going, hang on a second, man, and they walk out and they're messing with the tube, you know, I'm like, no, man, listen, it's here. And they're like, oh my God, it sounds like the tube's going out. I'm like, yeah, my tube is going out, bro. So catch me while you can, man. Put some compression on it. Let's keep trucking.
I call it the midlife crisis pedal. It's just age.
Exactly what it is, man. Oh my gosh, too many late nights, man. That's what it is. But hey, I don't sound like Vince Gill anymore. So
it's, I mean, you know, like That's all right, man. Like yeah. It's a fine whiskey. It's a good bourbon. That's what it is.
It's good. I appreciate that, man. Thank you, man.
Thanks. Yeah, dude, congrats on everything again. You're a legend, and I'm just so glad we got to do this.
Dude, thank you so much. I'd love to do it again. Let's do it another 15 years.
Yeah, that's what I was about to say. I hope I'm dead in 15 years.
No, I appreciate you, brother. Thanks for doing this. Great, great podcast. Thanks for supporting all us crazy friends of yours, man. It's fun.
Of course. That's what I'm supposed to do. I'm supposed to love on you people. What am I, a critic? Oh, screw those people. It's John Randall, everybody. If you got to end this conversation, you are a trooper, and you know how just amazing it was. Now you got to go listen to the Marfa tapes if you haven't already. And also, go listen to Neon Texas if you haven't already. You will be blessed by the Texas music gods that now this is in your life. You will love it and appreciate it. I'm so glad we had this conversation. And you guys will experience the magic and wonderment of all. John Randall, amazing. Thank you so much for popping on the show and doing the thing. Now it's time for you people to do something. You know, besides listening to the music, be sure to stop over on social medias, everything that John Randall has. Be sure to say, hey, we heard you. We talked to that guy. He was okay. You were wonderful. Well, I don't know. You know, then pop over to see me. Add us to my podcast, Facebook, Twitter, at Unofficial Brandon on the Instagram and the talks. All I ever ask, especially when you listen to this, if something touched you in the old pitter-patter and the old heart, I just ask you to share it, because you never know what people are actually going through. They don't tell you these things, so they might find something related in this. So always ask, just share. Also, subscribe, follow in your favorite podcast app, because we have new episodes that come out every Tuesday. Every once in a while, I'll sprinkle them in on Thursdays. All right, thanks guys for listening. I really do appreciate it. I'm grateful. And until next time, happy surviving.